man for not an invitation. And, well, it was rejected. And so they got together again, and they were agonizing. Well, why don't we get the most intelligent preacher that we can find? And so they sent out a second invitation. And, well, it was rejected. So they got back together and they discussed. They said, well, why don't we at least get the most handsome preacher we can find? Wait for it. And so I said, well, since you've invited me three times, I guess I'll have to come. So here I am. Last night, Clint Davidson, Clint, he's over here, he came up to me excited. He said, you got a like? What's a like? And I understand that these lessons are going out on the internet and people can listen to them or watch them, I guess. And then they can say if they like it or they don't like it. I got a like. Man, I was ecstatic. Then he said, it was your wife. She gave me a thumbs up. My countenance fell. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 3, and we're going to get into the text today. I thought about talking to you about my idea of heaven and a better rest, but those are just my opinions. I want you to hear what God is saying about this concept of a better rest as he uses the Hebrews writer in trying to encourage those to whom he's writing. And so we're going to work our way through chapter 3 and the first 11 verses of chapter 4. We won't get into great detail, but I tell you, these chapters kind of will turn you every which way but loose. They can be very confusing about this idea of rest and how he presents it. And so we're going to try to unravel some of that for you this morning. I first wondered if the land of Canaan, which would be part of the comparison here, whenever you say better than, which is the theme of this lectureship, you always have to have a comparison. And so the comparison that we're going to see is what Moses offered in the land of Canaan. And I wondered, did he ever call that a rest? And he did. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 9, he refers to it as a resting place and inheritance. And so it is a rest that Moses offered originally to the people of Israel. Now, this word rest is not a very common term. You find the noun one time in Acts chapter 7, and the verb one time in Acts chapter 14, but you find the noun eight times here in chapters 3 and 4, and the verb three times in those chapters. So here are the chapters, here in the New Testament, is the entire focus of what God has to say about this rest. The word rest just simply means to cause to cease. It doesn't mean that you just throw up your, you lean back in your lazy boy and put your feet up. It's not that. It means literally to cause to cease. You cease an activity. And that's what this term means. Several weeks ago, about 6 weeks now, on Saturday afternoon, which is sort of my time of rest at home, and I headed down to the man cave, you know, which is sort of routine for me on a Saturday afternoon. And I was going to watch a golf tournament. I enjoy doing that. And we had a storm and lightning hit our house. It was amazing. It was a huge sound and pop. And we lost some things. We lost the dishwasher and we lost the television. We lost the electronics. Exercise machine. Don't miss that much. And some wall sockets never have returned. And of course, all of the internet and electricity was gone, at least temporarily. And so I couldn't watch TV. You couldn't make a cup of coffee. So I just sat down with that woman I live with, and we had a talk. And, you know, she seems to really be a nice person. And we discussed about our future plans and our declining years, and that we like to travel. We want to travel. And years ago, we had a little travel trailer, and I suggested, why don't we get an RV? Wouldn't that be great? I have great memories of our children and our travels. And she said, no. And I'm wondering who this strange woman is that I'm living with. And then she said, over my dead body. And I'm thinking, I'm going to put wheels and a trailer hitch on her casket if she's going to travel with me. And then she explained. She said, you know, when you do RVing, you still have to sweep the floor, you have to make up the beds, you have to cook, you have to wash all of the dishes, and you have to pack up and then unpack, and that's not rest for me. I want to fly. I want to stay in Holiday Inn. Now, if you're willing, she said to me, to sweep the floor and cook the meals and do the dishes and make the beds, then I'll go with you in an RV. We're going to be flying and staying in Holiday Inn. But she's right. Rest means cease an activity. And she has in mind a better rest than all of that activity that she's been involved in. Now, that's what you have to keep in mind if you're going to understand what the writer is saying to his original readers here in chapter 3 and chapter 4, verses 1 through 11 of Hebrews. So let's work through some of the technical things as we read the text, and we'll just take it a little section at a time and talk about that. Let's read the first six verses of chapter 3. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all his house. For he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Now, there's a lot here that we will not be able to discuss, but you recognize that we have a heavenly calling and that we want to be partakers with whatever it is that Christ offers. And there's a contrast or a comparison between Christ and Moses in this section. Now, these are two great leaders of God's people. Now, it says Moses was over his house, and you got to always, when you're studying Hebrews, pay attention to the personal pronouns, because they will confuse you. Who's he? When he says his house, is he talking about Moses' house, or is he talking about Moses in God's house? And that's what he's talking about, God's house. God only has one house or one household. It is the people of God, but we have the people of God existing in Moses' day, but they're also existing in the Hebrews writers' day. They are Christians as well as Israelites. And so in that portion of God's house, Moses was a servant. But now we have something superior. Our leader is the son, not the servant. And so we have a superior leader leading us to a rest. Moses led his people to a rest. Our leader will also lead us to a rest. But he is warning them that they have to hold fast. Verse 6. Now, he writes that, as we've already indicated, and this has been pointed out in, I think, several lectures, that these are people receiving this particular writing of the Hebrew. We call it a letter. It says letter to the Hebrews in your Bible. But, of course, it's a tract or a sermon notes or something like that. But he's writing to them to hang on, to not let go. Because apparently they're becoming very sluggish, very lethargic, very apathetic. They're losing their confidence. They're losing their grip on their faith. They're about to let go. And so he's writing this to tell them to keep on keeping on. We have a better leader here in the Son than the Israelites had in Moses. Now, he shifts gears here at verse 7. Verses 7 through 11 is a quotation from the scriptures that these people would be very familiar with. Listen to what he says. Therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me and by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their heart. They do not know my ways, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Now, he's quoting from Psalm 95. Now, I think we need to sort of place ourselves into a historic perspective. In Psalm 95, David is referring to an incident that occurred many centuries earlier in the time of Moses, when Moses led the people of Israel out of Egypt, and he led them up to the edge of the promised land where they camped in Kadesh Barnea. And they did not go into the promised land. They hardened their hearts. And so David is saying to his generation, let's not harden our hearts like they did. That's the point of Psalm 95. Now, I want you to think in terms of way back there, that's time period number one. That's when Moses led the people out of Egypt. And then here is David's time, Psalm 95, when David is talking. And then over here is time period number three, where the Hebrews writer is writing to his people. So you've got these three different time periods to deal with in understanding what the writer is actually saying. So let's move on at verse 12. He says, take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God, but encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. While it is today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. The Hebrew writer is quoting from David's time period, and David, in that quotation, is referring back to a previous time period of the days of Moses. And the Hebrew writer is making an application based upon the actual event and what David said about that event. And he's making that application to his readers. And folks, we can move even from that time period to our time period, and the same application can be made to us. Now, what he's saying is, you need to listen to what David said. He said, today, if you hear his voice. do not harden your hearts. David is talking about not hardening their hearts like the ancient Israelites did and were not allowed to enter the rest. He's saying, if you do that to his people in his day, then you will be left out. God will not allow you to enter his rest. Now, the interesting thing is that David lives in the land that Moses promised. He's in the Canaan rest. That's where he lives. And so when he says today, he's not talking about the Canaan rest. He's saying there's another rest. And so today, you need to enter that rest. And so the Hebrews writer is saying the same thing. And he says here in verse 13, we need to encourage one another day after day as long as it is called today. And he's referring back to verse 7 where he quoted from Psalm 95 where David said, today, if you hear his voice. Now, I want you to think about that as long as it's called today. You can encourage one another. Now, folks, tomorrow, you can't encourage me. You can't do it tomorrow. Number one, you're not promised tomorrow. God hasn't given us tomorrow, has he? We don't know if we're going to have tomorrow or not. Besides, I won't be here. You can't encourage me yesterday. That's gone. Whatever happened yesterday happened, and we can't go back and relive that. Some of you here encourage me. I'm waiting on others. But we can't, you can't do it yesterday. You can do it today as long as it is called today. And what he means is, as long as we have today's, day after day, we have today. And as long as we have those today's, then we have that opportunity to encourage one another to never give up, to never let go, and to enter the rest that God intended for us. Now, he's drawing all of that from the original actual event of Moses and applying it from the things that David said in Psalm 95 in an entirely different generation. But David could not be talking about the rest that Moses promised because he's already in that. He's living there. So there's something else involved. Now, verse 16. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, not all of those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Now here he's interpreting the example that David used in Psalm 95. He's helping you to understand what David was saying in his time period. And he's saying he's referring back to an actual event that occurred in the days of Moses. And you remember the story of what happened there. Moses led them out of Egypt. He got them to the edge of the land of promise, the Canaan land. He sent those 12 spies into the land to look it over, to do reconnaissance. And they all came back, and you remember that Joshua and Caleb said, it's a great land that God has given us. He will fight our battles. Let's go in and take the land. But there were 10 spies who said, yes, it's a great land. But those guys over there are huge. They're giants. And they've suited up for battle. And they have fortified cities. And we're like grasshoppers in their sight. And they will stomp us like bugs. We're not going in. We cannot take the land. Now God said, go take the land. They had a word from God. I'm giving you the land. Just go in and take the land. But the Hebrews writer is saying, by their disobedience, you recognize their unbelief. They did not believe the word of God. Now this is what hardening the heart is all about. A hardened heart is a heart that is like granite. Nothing can penetrate. The truth cannot penetrate a hardened heart. A hardened heart is when you've got your mind already made up and you think you have the truth. And so when you think you have the truth, but it's not the truth, and you compare it to whatever is presented to you as the truth, it disagrees with what is presented to you. Therefore, you reject the truth, holding on to what you already have made up your mind to accept, so your heart is hardened against the actual truth. God says, it's yours, just go in. Moses says, it's yours, just go in and take it. Joshua and Caleb said, it's ours, the Lord will fight our battles for us. But the rest did not accept that. They had closed their minds. They had made up their minds. They doubted in unbelief. Whenever you doubt, it leads to inactivity. Always. Why is it that you have not swum, is that a word? Swum the English Channel. Swam. Thank you. Yesterday I was spelling. Did you help me with that too? Thank you. Senior moments I'm having here. Why haven't you done that? I don't think I can do it. Whenever you don't think, you can accomplish something, when you doubt, that leads to inactivity. These people are letting go of their faith. They're losing it. They are letting go of their confidence. It's not that they don't believe in God or Christ. They understand that. That's not what they're losing. But they're letting go of the word that God has sent them. I have something for you. It's laid up for you in the future. Can you see it? We see it only through the eyes of faith. Do you see yourself receiving it? We can only see that through the eyes of faith. Faith, chapter 11, is assurance of things hoped for. The conviction of things not seen. And the only way we'll be able to please God is to accept that and to live and act in accordance with what He has said and what He has promised. We are faithful to His word. But here, disobedience and unbelief are parallel. When they disobeyed by not coming into the promised land, it indicated their unbelief. Now look at chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, that's concluding word, let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering His rest, any one of you may have come short of it. For indeed we have had good news preached to us, just as they also, but the word they heard did not profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. So now he's exhorting his readers in his period of time, based upon what happened in Moses' time, and based upon what David said, in his time, we need to be careful. We need to fear. We have a promise remaining of rest that we can enter. Let's not come short of that. And we're just like those people. We have had good news. They had good news. Take the land. It's yours. I'm giving it to you. but it was not united in faith with those who heard. And so these people, by their actions, are really mimicking, repeating the mistakes of those people, the house of God, in the days of Moses. Now, the writer wants now to establish for their minds the idea that there is a promise, a remaining promise of a rest. So all of that is just my introduction. Now I'm ready to preach my lesson. And I only have a couple hours to do it. So I only have a few minutes. Here are the two points that I want you to see that the writer is making. The first one is found here in verses 3 through 9. It's a better rest because it's God's rest. And then second point is verses 10 and 11. It's a better rest because Christ has entered it before us. All right, listen to that first point, verse 3. For we who have believed enter that rest, just as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. Now don't miss what he's emphasizing here. He's still quoting from David, but now he's emphasizing something. The emphasis is on my rest. God, of course, is speaking through David in Psalm 95. And he's saying here, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. And then the Hebrews writer makes a comment, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. So now I take this even earlier to Moses. That takes us all the way back to the creation week, doesn't it? And he's referring to the fact that on the seventh day, God rested. Now, he's not through proving that point. Look at verse 4. For he said somewhere concerning the seventh day, God rested on the seventh day from all his works. That's Genesis 2 and verse 2. And then again, in this passage, they shall not enter my rest. What's he doing? He's trying to show you that there's an entirely different rest than what Moses offered. And it predates Moses because God entered it when he finished his works of creation. And then when he spoke through David, guess what? He's still in his rest. It's being offered in the time of David. He's still in that rest today, the writer is saying. It is God's own rest that he's offering you. It is so much better than what Moses could offer. And so hang on to that idea, and it's kind of technical, but the writer really knows his Old Testament, and he knows his theology. In verse 6, he says, therefore, since it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day. What is that day? It's today. Saying through David, after so long a time, just as has been said before, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. You see, he repeats, because this is a little difficult to grab hold of. We have a rest. And it's better than Moses because it goes all the way back. It is God's rest. It's what he entered into on the seventh day. He's still in it in David's time, and he's still in it today. And so we learn two things about this concept of God's rest. Number one, it means to cease an activity. God rested from his creative labor. He ceased creating. No more days are created. No more worlds are created. God quit. That's what rest means, number one. Number two means it is everlasting. He continues in it. He doesn't ever get out of it. And so the better rest that God offers us is His own rest, where we cease from earthly activity and we enter into an eternal rest with God. Now he continues to explain that in verses 8 and 9. He said, for if Joshua, now he switched from Moses to Joshua, because you remember that Moses was not allowed to enter into the land of Canaan. Joshua is the one that took the people on in and fought the wars. If Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And here he's using an entirely different word for the term rest, because now he's talking about God's rest, in which he entered on the seventh day, in which he was still in the days of David, and he's still in that rest when the Hebrews writer is writing, and guess what? He's still in that rest today. Now, it doesn't mean that God got tired and that God just quit working. Jesus said, my Father is working unto now, and I also am working. John 5 and verse 17. And some of our speakers have used Romans 8 and verse 28. God causes all things to work together for good to those who love Him. He's still active. Rest does not mean inactivity. It means cause to cease. One particular thing. God ceased creation. He was done. And now He's in that continual rest. I've got to move on. Verse 10. Here's the second point. It's a greater rest because Christ has entered. Verse 10 says, for the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. Now that sounds like anybody that enters God's rest will rest from his works. But that's not what the writer is saying. In fact, some translation says, whoever has entered his rest. But in the Greek, there is no relative pronoun, whoever or whomever. There is no personal pronoun, he. There's only an article, the. It's masculine. It's literally the one. And I believe that he's not talking about all of us or anyone else. He's talking about one individual, Christ himself. The tense of that verb, entered, speaks of what has already occurred. He has already entered, and he has entered into God's rest. And he himself has rested from his labor. The word rest means cause to cease. It doesn't mean inactivity or anything like that. But just as God ceased creation activity, guess what? Christ accomplished redemption, and now he's done with that. It's been done. He's no longer having to do any work of redemption because that is accomplished. So he has entered in ahead of us into God's own rest, himself having rested from what he was sent to accomplish. And so the Hebrews writer in verse 11 makes that final exhortation when he says, therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. He's trying to convince these people, you got to keep on keeping on. Don't you realize what we have here? We have something greater than what Moses could offer. We have a leader that was so superior to Moses. And he has conquered everything. And he has entered into God's own rest. And he's waiting there for us. There are so many passages and indications in Hebrews about where Jesus is now and what he's doing now. He has passed through the heavens. He has entered through the veil. He is a forerunner. He is the author, which is a word that can be translated as origin or source or pioneer. And my favorite is trailblazer. In chapter 12 and verse 3, in chapter 2 and verse 10, he's the trailblazer, which means that he blazed the trail for us, and he's now at the end of the journey, waiting for us to follow him. He has entered in before us. We could not get in unless Christ has entered first and accomplished the work of redemption. He is now sat down at the right hand because his work is done. He's caused that to cease. The work of redemption is done. Everything has been paid. We were kidnapped by sin. He paid the price, the ransom for our freedom. Why would you turn your back on that is what the Hebrews writer is saying to these people. Jesus is there calling out to you. In chapter 12 and verse 3, he says, you fix your eyes on Jesus. Why? Because he's at the finish line. And he's encouraging you. Come on. Don't give up. You can make it. And so they've taken their eyes off of Jesus and off the goal when they get distracted by the troubles of this realm. That's what happened to the children of Israel. We're too little. They're too big. They're not listening. They're not focused on their God and what he has said. And folks, God has given his last message in this person, Christ Jesus. Here's the final word. And it brings to us the greater rest that God wants us to have. Before Moses went up on that mountain and God took his life, he talked to the people, encouraging them. He said, you're going to go into a land that God has promised you. It's wonderful. You're going to be in cities that you did not build. We have a better rest. We're going to a city that has walls 1,500 miles high and 1,500 miles wide. It is safe and secure. There's a street of gold in that city that we're going to. That's better than anything Moses offered. He said, you're going to live in houses that you did not construct. Jesus said, my Father has a mansion. I'm going to prepare a place in that palace for you. Moses said, it's a land flowing with milk and honey. And look at the cluster of grapes brought back by these spies. It took two men to carry them. Galatians 22 says, we have a tree of life that produces 12 kinds of fruit every month. You never run out. In the land of Canaan, they continued to sin. They continued to die. They continued to have pain and anguish and anxiety. But we're headed for a land where there will be no crying. There will be no pain. There will be no dying. No saying goodbye. And no sin. We have a taste of that now. In the church. But we get the full benefit in heaven. Let's be diligent to enter that rest. Thank you.